Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to the people behind Green Street Records, a record label run by University of Illinois students. We also visit a rock climbing facility in Bloomington fashioned from old grain silos. We hear how the lessons of the television franchise Star Trek have made their way into a college course, and we explore the meaning of the word no. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. On the surface, Green Street Records looks like any other record label. They search out young talent, get them into a recording studio, and produce CDs. But the remarkable thing is, Green Street Records is a nonprofit student organization at the University of Illinois, and according to them, the only student-run record label in the Big Ten. Last year, they released their first CD called Emergence. It was a compilation of 12 local student bands, and it was distributed free to fellow students. Green Street Records is currently in the process of putting together their next compilation. I recently checked in with them to see how it was going. It's a Tuesday evening on the University of Illinois campus. Four guys meet in one of the unused classrooms in Lincoln Hall. These four are the founders of Green Street Records, a record label run by and for University of Illinois students, featuring bands with students in them. Right now, the four, Jason Drucker, Josh Morton, Aaron Rosenthal, and Jonathan Rosen, are planning the layout for their upcoming compilation. This is the second year the label has put out an album. Green Street Records does everything from picking the bands to getting them in the studio to marketing and distribution. They start to wrap up their small meeting as other students file in. This is the rest of the record label's staff. They're here for a general meeting. Rosenthal, president of Artists and Repertoire, is a little amazed at how the label has grown.
Yeah, it's been pretty incredible. We started out with four people last year, and initially, you kind of need a more focused effort to lay the groundwork for what you're going to do. But this year we said, let's let more people get involved. And the response has just been incredible. We have about 30 very, very excited, very motivated staff to work with this year.
Morton, president of public relations, says Green Street Records basically grew out of the four's love of music.
We definitely all want to be part of the music industry. We all want to get into the industry and make changes in the industry and you know, filter in from that section. But most importantly, we want to do it for the music. We want students to hear the great music that's in Champaign-Urbana. We want the record labels out there to hear the great music that's in Champaign-Urbana. What we want to do is we want to make these bands known. We want to put their music out there. And if the bands get big, that's great. If we get into the industry and have jobs, that's great too. We're getting experience. No other place can you get experience working with bands, working with press, and in a recording studio than here.
Green Street Records has partnered with local recording studio Pogo, and according to Drucker, is actually able to offer the bands more studio time this year.
Each band is actually getting 8 hours to record, which is over twice what we gave bands last year. So the actual recording quality is going to be just worlds better than last year. And, you know, I was happy with how it turned out last year, so I'm really excited to see how it turns out this year.
It's the following Saturday, and the band Triple Whip is recording over at Pogo Studios. They are one of the 13 bands that will be featured on the new compilation, which will be titled Playlisted. Bands have been coming in all month, a few each week, to record the one song they will be contributing to the album. Mark Rubel, head of Pogo, is moving his hands across the vintage mixing board, adjusting levels. He was brought on by Green Street Records to produce the bands, and is pretty happy with what he sees the record label doing.
Well, I'm very proud of them. I think it's an idea that whose time has certainly come. I think that it's, you know, many people have ideas for projects, but the percentage of people who have those ideas that actually follow through and complete a project is quite small. And so for somebody to say that they're going to do something and to do it in a very effective way, to complete it, to repeat it, and to provide for it to go on, I think is very admirable. I also think it's great job training for them. And I think for anyone who wants to get involved in music or the music industry, the best way to learn is by doing it. And I think that it would be very good for them. I think it's very good for the Champaign-Urbana music community. and for music in general. So it's, I think, as far as I'm concerned, it's positive all around.
On Sunday, another band, the Eleanors, are in the studio. Drucker and Rosen from Green Street Records are sitting in the control room, along with the band, listening back to what has just been recorded. Eleanor's guitarist, Adriel Harris, has nothing but praise for Green Street Records.
I think that it's really awesome. I really appreciate Green Street's enthusiasm for the local music scene, independent music scene. In our first meeting with them, they were just incredibly excited and supportive of all the musicians, and I was really appreciative of that. Felt instantly welcome and kind of a part of the family. I felt from the beginning just real comfortable with kind of sharing our music with them, and they've been really respectful and just genuinely excited about it and very kind people, and I'm really excited.
Rosen, who is president of advertising, is optimistic that Green Street Records will continue even when he and the rest of the founders graduate and move on.
And our hope is that we find individuals that step up and prove that they're capable and they have the time and the desire to take our post in the future. And we really hope that this continues beyond our tenure here.
Once all the bands have recorded and the songs mixed down, Green Street Records will move on to the production, promotion, and distribution phase of this project. If all goes as planned, the album should be out by the end of April. For Sidetrack, I'm Jason Croft. Listening to Sidetrack. Prairie Fire, WILL-TV's award-winning program about Illinois people, places, and history, has just started its latest season. One of the stories they recently aired was a feature on Skins and Tins Drum Shop in downtown Champaign. The two main voices you'll hear in this piece are those of owners Terry and Liz Hawkins.
You won't find harmonicas, you won't find accordions, you won't find saxophones here. That's the reason why I opened this drum shop in the first place, because I felt the need for drummers to have their own place to go to and hang out without that stuff. You know, all we have is stuff to beat on, with sticks or your hands.
We live, breathe, eat, sleep drums. That's what we do. Wouldn't have it any other way.
What do you say to a drummer in a three-piece suit? Will the defendant please rise? I know, it's rough. It's rough for the drummers, isn't it?
I moved away from here for about 5 years, came back, and a good friend of mine, Ron Sullivan, over at Prime Light Studios, we decided to put together a little rockabilly band, so I went around to the local stores.
Most of the stores at that time in this area would, if they had a little bit of stuff in stock, would give him a catalog to order something out of.
Then I thought, aha, there's a void there. We need a drum shop in Champaign.
I thought he was kind of crazy at the time, but lo and behold, it's turned out really well. So, and there is a need for it. We're the only percussion store between St. Louis, Chicago, and Annapolis, and we have people that come from all over to shop here.
I love being around percussion instruments. I've always loved drums. Every day is a learning experience. Something about percussion, or something about a drum, or the history of a drum, or the person that played on a certain record you like, you know, or you meet this person. Been really successful in doing things that I
thought I'd never ever get to do drum-wise. I've met a lot of my favorite drummers that I never envisioned of meeting. Just meeting a whole lot of people, a whole lot of friends.
When we first started up, we started with, I believe it was one drum set, a few pair of sticks, a couple of drum heads. And over the years, it took like 5 years of building inventory.
And we don't try just to have the normal. We try to get things that are just a little off the beaten track so that when somebody does want something rather unusual, we try to fill that in.
Don't try this at home.
So when we're buying things, I always pick out things that like, you know, I like that, so I'm thinking somebody else might like that.
Not one.
But two.
I don't know that I have one favorite story. There's so many of them.
The best in-store story that I have is, there's many of them. Three of them happen to be when people decide to make this store a drive-through. Three times people have drove through the front window. One time, lady came right up to the cash register with her car. I mean, people still talk about that. One historical thing that I really was proud of putting on was William F. Ludwig. I've always been a Ludwig fan. I've always played Ludwig drums and got an opportunity to have him come here and do a clinic. There's a guy from here in town, Doug Gurna, who works with Bonnie Raitt. And they were getting ready to do the Letterman show out in New York. And he called me and he goes, man, I've been to every drum shop in New York City. I need this certain rim for the drummer tonight. You know, we're doing this filming, you know, or actually it was the next day. He broke this drum. Have you got this part? And I go, man, it's in the mail right now. One exciting evening I had was when the Hot Chili Peppers and Foo Fighters were playing at the Assembly Hall, and I got a call from Taylor Hawkins' drum tech wanting to know if I had a certain pieces of equipment. Well, yeah, I did, so I went over there to help him out. He couldn't believe that a drum shop out in the middle of a cornfield here could supply him with what stuff he needed. They're one of the bands that, you know, I really enjoy listening to. Taylor Hawkins is a great percussionist. And then, the other guy in the band, Dave Grohl, was the drummer for Nirvana, so that was kind of cool getting to meet him.
I've had out-of-town players come in town to play in the area and have visited the store and said that they have heard of us. And I think that's really neat that people around the country know that, you know, we're here or they've heard of us.
Do you know what the difference between a bass player and a drummer is?
Is this a joke?
What is the difference between a bass player and a drummer?
About half a beat.
About half a beat. Am I supposed to be telling this?
A half a beat. There you go.
I got a famous quote from Buddy Rich, and that is, the band is only as good as the drummer. The guitar player can hit a bad note, and people still keep grooving, dancing, but if the drummer drops a beat, you know, you're like, everybody knows it. So, you know, it's really important for drummers to be heard and seen.
Who is my favorite drummer? It has to be my husband, because I enjoy watching him play.
You can see that story about Skins and Tins Drum Shop on the program Prairie Fire, which airs Wednesday nights at 7:30 on our companion station, WILL-TV. Thank you. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Imagine climbing a mountain in Bloomington. Well, it's not really a mountain. It's actually a group of grain silos set up for rock climbers. Courtney Bartels is general marketing manager of Upper Limits. She showed Jiffy Johnson around this unusual facility, one of the largest in the world. Bartels explains who created it and why.
Pam and Chris Schmick were looking for an opportunity or building to start a rock climbing gym, and they came across this abandoned grain elevator, and you know, the light bulb just went off in their head saying this would be something great and different, and it just kind of went from there. And it's prospered now. We'll be open 10 years next September.
You're sort of a mountain in Bloomington.
Yeah, a lot of people do say that. We brought the mountains from everywhere else to central Illinois, the plains of, you know, the Midwest.
I see, as we start through the doorway here, a collection of protrusions in odd shapes and sizes on the wall, and this is an opportunity for people to get a first crack at this?
Yes, we've got the holds or simulation of what would be rocks outside screwed into the walls so that people can actually climb up particular routes as you would find a route outdoors on a natural rock face. We try to simulate the outdoors as much as possible, but it is difficult to do because we are indoors and it's not actual rock.
How high is this up?
Okay, this area that we're actually in right now is our main climbing area that we call it, and it is only 30 feet. We'll go into the silos in a bit there, which those are actually 65 feet tall, and then outside we do actually have routes that are up to 110 feet tall.
Can you use those outside routes in the middle of the winter when it's icy?
No, we do not use them in the winter. It's normally just during the nicer weather months.
When people are climbing on this surface, they're starting out with somebody coaching them. How do they first get a crack at this?
First thing that we recommend doing if you've never climbed anywhere before is you would come in and take our Rock Gym 101 class or a family class where a parent and a child could take the class together, and you would learn all the basics and safety aspects for climbing indoors here safely. You would learn how to tie in as a climber and how to belay, which is the belayer is the safety person on the ground that protects the climber as they climb up the wall. Once you've taken that class, you're pretty much going to be set to climb here indoors. We've got all the gear that you would need. You can either purchase your own. We've got a fully stocked pro shop, or you could just rent any gear that you would need as well. You know, while people are climbing, we've got staff or what we call climbing lifeguards walking around to make sure that everyone is still doing everything correctly and safely. There's three different types of climbing that we do here at Upper Limits. The first type is bouldering or traversing, which is climbing very low to the ground, kind of side to side. You don't go up very high and you're not tied into a rope because you're not going more than 8 to 10 feet off the ground. So your chance of falling is a little bit less or getting injured from a fall isn't very high. Then the second type is top rope climbing, whereas you can see the ropes that you just mentioned. The rope is anchored at the top, so you've got one end of the rope that the climber would be tied into. The rope goes all the way up to the top of the route, or the top of the wall, is anchored at the top, and then it comes back down at the other end of the rope, which the belayer would clip into, and the belayer would use that end of the rope then to protect the climber as they climb up the wall.
Now, Kevin Todd, you're one of the climbers that's out here on occasion, and you're going to show me a little bit about how you start to climb.
Well, I definitely need to get a harness on. That's a safety device that goes around my legs and my waist and will prop, you know, catch me in the proper style in case I do fall. You know, it'll support me so I don't flip upside down, give a good grab on me so the belayer can catch. And also get my rock climbing shoes on, which look pretty close to ballerina slippers. They're very, very tight fit and have some stiff, sticky rubber on the bottom of them so that your feet can get really good purchase on the tiniest holds.
We'll follow you in as you've now got your shoes on and you've got your belt on, but this surface is really strange. What is this black stuff?
Well, they've got chopped tires.
Recycled rubber.
On the floor just to help give a little extra cushion. Courtney mentioned earlier that we do have bouldering in here. And when bouldering, you can get several feet off the ground. And it's definitely a good idea to have a spotter to make sure you come down on your feet. But just to give you some extra cushion, help protect your ankles and knees and everything, we've got the softer surface for you to land on.
Now, you're tying a rope so that you can go up, and you're being very careful about what kind of knots you're using. I assume that's a big part of the training?
Absolutely, yeah. You definitely want to use the correct knot. If you don't, it puts extra stress on the rope, and it's not as strong if you don't use the right knot.
So now you've got the knot tied to your harness. You've got your shoes on. You're ready to go?
We're going to check each other out first, Courtney and I will, to make sure we both clipped into the rope correctly to prevent any accidents. So I'm going to look at Courtney's harness and make sure that she's doubled back around her waist. And she's got a carabiner going through two different points there. And the carabiner's locked up. It can't open unless she manually does that. And then she's got a rope running through her belay device, and it looks good. So she's ready to go.
And then you're going to check him?
Yes, and then on Kevin, again, I will check his harness to make sure it's double-backed. He's going through the two points in his harness with his rope. I will double-check his knot to make sure that it is tied correctly and that he's got a safety knot as well.
Okay, so now you're ready.
Now we are ready to go.
What's the first step? Where do you go?
I'm going to walk over to the wall, and we've got all the holds on here color-coded. So when you're climbing a route, the goal is to get to the top using just one color. So I'm going to do this yellow one over here.
What are you talking about? These little things that are about the size of my hand or, well, even less? I think this one is about 2 inches across, maybe?
That's right. They come in all different shapes and sizes just to keep things interesting. The small one you're looking at, most people would use it as a foot. It's hardly good enough to hold on with your hand. But as you see, some of the other ones are quite a bit bigger. They look like handlebars or a softball sticking out of the wall. So they're all different shapes and sizes.
So where are you going to put your first foot?
So look for all the yellow holds.
So this is actually what you would really do if you were rock climbing a mountain. You would be assessing for a while first.
Oh, yeah. You got to look for all the best places. Otherwise, you'll be wasting energy. So I'm going to make sure Courtney's ready to go. I'm going to ask her if the belay's on.
Belay's on.
And then I'm going to tell her I'm climbing.
Climb on.
So he's putting his feet on some extremely small ledges, two, just a few feet above the ground. And then he's angling way off to the right-hand side for the next foothold, and then I have no idea where that left foot can go. Kevin, okay, there, you're going to go there. And he's already, well, almost 6 feet off the ground just by holding on to some extremely small spots. And what's your job back here?
I'm belaying for Kevin, so as he's climbing up the wall, he's forming slack in the rope, so I'm going to pull the rope up, or the slack out of the rope, so that if he were to fall, he really wouldn't fall anywhere. The rope's going to be tight the whole time that he's climbing up the wall.
He'd just be swinging in the breeze instead of on the rock face.
Yep, it would just be like sitting in a chair, actually, if you were to let go of the wall. Your harness kind of forms a seat for you, so it's not as uncomfortable or as scary as it would sound.
And he's basically got a toe hold, and when I say that, I literally mean he's using his big toe and maybe two adjacent toes, and that's about all the surface he has to work with. The back of the foot's doing nothing other than hanging out.
Yeah, a lot of the times, certain footholds, as he mentioned earlier, are very small. There's just enough room there for you to get your toes on. Easier climbers, when you first start out, you're going to be on trying different routes and using a lot bigger holds. Kevin's been doing this for quite some time, so he can try something that's a little bit harder where the holds aren't as big. But a beginner is going to start with something that, you know, has a lot more space, a lot more holds, where the holds are nice and big for you to get your feet and hands on easily.
Hey, Kevin, shout down to us. Tell us how you're doing up there.
Well, I just got up to the top, so I'm going to ask Courtney to take.
Gotcha.
She'll take all the slack out of the rope and hold my body weight, and then I'm going to ask her to lower me.
Lowering.
And she'll let a little bit of her grip off of that belay device, and it'll slowly bring me down to the ground.
And obviously you don't want to do this too quickly because he wants to have some control as he pushes himself off the rock face.
If you start lowering someone too fast, the rope's just going to move too quickly through your hands and you're going to hurt yourself as the belayer. And you'll eventually end up losing control of the rope and your climber will fall. And you don't want them to fall.
Now how close, Kim, is this to the real thing out there where there's a, you know, not a man-made toe hold here and there?
It's pretty close. Of course, there's definitely some differences in here. Everything's colored or marked. So I definitely know where I'm going. Outside, there's a lot more variation in the angles of the rock. It can be a lot more difficult to find your next hold, but it's about as close as it gets.
And when did you start doing this?
I started just a couple of years ago. My uncle's been doing it for some time, and he got me interested in it.
Now, we were in the shorter area, but I understand, Courtney, there's a higher area.
Yes.
Can you show us that next?
Sure.
Oh my goodness, it goes way up. And this is an empty grain silo.
Yep, there used to be a lot of soybeans in this room. So they cleared it all out and cleaned it up, and now it's used for rock climbing. So as you can notice, there's about 8 different routes or paths you can take up to the very top, all at different skill levels, all the way from the absolute complete beginner to someone that's very experienced and advanced.
Now, right now, winter, it's pretty chilly in here, and I'm sure you can work up a good sweat, but what happens in the summer? Don't silos get awfully toasty?
It does get a little warm. We're pretty good about getting the air circulating, though, through. We do have vents. and the air circulation on at all times. It can get a little warm. Obviously, the higher you go up, the little bit warmer it's going to get. But it's really not too bad because they are cement walls. A lot of times it will trap the cold in longer than what it really is outside. So that kind of helps.
So as we come back out of the silo area, there's several silos, as you mentioned, and you have a small gift shop. This is an unusually large facility compared to some of the others that are of this sort, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We are one of the largest climbing facilities in the nation, possibly even the whole world. At one point, we were the biggest, but I think there's a few that have expanded, so they're a little bit bigger. But we've got over 20,000 square feet total for climbing. Most other gyms, if you go to the suburb area of Chicago or in other big cities, they don't have the space that we have here. So they're probably 10 to 15,000 square feet. It's just a guess off the top of my head. People want to call if they have any questions. Our phone number is 309-829-TALL or 829-8255. And all of our programs and everything are listed on our website as well, which is www.upperlimits.com.
Courtney Bartels is General Marketing Manager, and Kevin Todd is a regular climber at Upper Limits in Bloomington. Reporting from Bloomington, I'm Jiffy Johnson.
Still to come on the program, Star Trek in the Classroom and the meaning of the word no. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Sometimes the best intentions can have the worst outcomes. Commentator Bill Hammack has the tale of a man who set out to improve the world, but ended up creating some of the greatest threats to our environment.
Two of the greatest environmental threats of the 20th century, leaded gas and freon, were the work of a single man named Thomas Midgley. Because of these two inventions, a historian described Midgley as having had more impact on the atmosphere than any other single organism in Earth history. In 1921, Thomas Midgley worked as an engineer in the General Motors research labs. His project was to get rid of engine knock. That's when the fuel doesn't burn evenly and makes the motor rattle. Engine knock wasted fuel, something scarce at the time. Midgley knew the solution was some kind of additive to the fuel, so he went on what he called a scientific fox hunt. It was a method he developed as a young man. In school, he and a teammate decided to find out what would make a spitball curve the best. They carefully tested substances until they came across slippery elm bark. Midgley used a similar process to find his fuel additive. He systematically tested compounds until he hit upon tetraethyl lead. This compound met his goal of increasing fuel conservation. With his lead additive, 2 gallons would go as far as 3 gallons without an additive. In fact, despised as lead gas is today, over the 25 years we used it, leaded gas saved about 1 billion barrels of oil. Of course, we now know the toxic effects of putting lead into the environment. After this success, Midgley worked on improving refrigerators and air conditioners. At the time, a refrigerator was a dangerous thing because it used toxic, flammable chemicals. Midgley, using the same scientific fox hunt as before, found a replacement for those nasty chemicals. CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons, what we now call freons. Today it strikes us as the most toxic thing in the world, yet its lack of toxicity and flammability is what attracted Midgley to it. To demonstrate its safety, he once took a mouthful of freon and blew it at a candle. It extinguished the flame, showing that freon was neither poisonous nor flammable. Of course, we learned in the 1970s that freon thins the ozone layer, the essential sunscreen that lets life on Earth thrive. There is a great irony in Midgley's career. He set out to improve our world, and yet, as that historian said, he had more impact on the atmosphere than any other single organism in Earth history. This irony was reflected in his own demise. In 1940, he contracted polio. He designed a system of ropes and pulleys to help him in and out of bed. One day he became entangled in this network of ropes and was killed by his own ingenuity.
The comments of Bill Hammack, who teaches chemical engineering at UIUC. His commentaries on engineering and life, which to him are one and the same, can be found on the web at engineerguy.com. This is SciTrak. Since it first went on the air nearly 40 years ago, Star Trek has attracted loyal fans, some of whom say the science fiction TV show presents a coherent philosophy for living. Dr. Michael O'Connor might not go so far, but the English professor at Millikan University in Decatur says the original Star Trek show and its many spin-offs provide a useful lens for looking at society, so useful that he's designed a course using Star Trek as the starting point. Jim Meadows talked with Dr. O'Connor to find out more.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
Michael O'Connor knows those words from the Star Trek opening titles well. He's been a fan of Star Trek since it first aired in the 1960s. Over the winter break, O'Connor was able to find an academic use for the long-running science fiction franchise. He taught a multidisciplinary immersion course at Millikan University using Star Trek as a way to look at a wide range of topics. O'Connor says the various Star Trek shows and movies from the 1960s until today tell a lot about the social context of their time. And he says the TV show that gave us matter transporters, holodecks, and faster-than-light warp drive had some scientific insights as well.
I brought in a physicist and a mathematician, and one of my guest lectures on speaking of the physics and science of Star Trek talked a lot about things that simply could probably never work, but then of course he came back and mentioned things that that did happen to come true.
What came true from Star Trek, at least in the last 40 years?
Well, a lot of it has to do with miniaturization. You go back with a particular eye towards things like their communicators, which looks almost exactly like all the cell phones that we carry today, things like storage of information. For computers, you take a look at their little things that they stored information on. They look exactly like the floppy drives that we used a few years ago, those sort of things.
The original Star Trek series, of course, took place hundreds of years in the future, but it was written by Americans in the 1960s. So how do you think that affected how they saw future events?
Well, I think it had a great effect, and that was one of the best parts of the class. We were able to talk a lot about history and politics of Star Trek, and just the attitudes of a sort of imperialist. Let's spread our particular brand of culture among all of the civilizations of the stars. Was interesting to look at both from the 60s perspective and, of course, from today's perspective.
What are some examples of that sort of benign cultural domination that the show may have exemplified?
Well, the main thing was one of Roddenberry's, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of the program, one of Roddenberry's main ideas was this concept of a prime directive. And so the number one law or rule of the Federation of Planets, which is very similar to, let's say, the United Nations or NATO at that time, one of the main rules or the primary rule was a non-interference act, the idea that if you ran across cultures that were less developed than yours, You had to risk life, limb, everything to not contaminate or influence that culture.
It was interesting that he did introduce that idea. How well was it adhered to by the characters?
Oh, that was the fun part. As you go through the captains of the different series, you see that Kirk from the 60s probably had the worst record for trying to follow the number one law of the Federation or the Prime Directive. He broke it almost every other show. You get into the 80s, and Picard, that particular captain, was doing better. It seems like the later you went in time of the actual production of the series, they seem to get better and better at it. Finally, the episode of with Captain Janeway, the female captain in Voyager, she was taking great pains to follow the Federation rules very carefully. So it was interesting to see that development through the history of the program itself.
How did the TV series, or how does the TV series, depict people from other worlds? Is there a generality or pattern you can see there?
There were some, especially in the original series from the 60s, there were some obvious political overtures of the Klingons, an alien race sort of being representative of the Soviet Union, whereas the Federation in that dichotomy represented the United States. You would have other cultures like the Romulans, who seemed to represent maybe the Red Chinese, or certainly an Eastern sort of group. But all of these groups were sort of presented as the outsider threat, I think, vestiges of the Cold War of that time. In some of the secondary series, you had some very interesting developments of races like the Ferengi, who were totally obsessed with money and wealth, seeming to satirize capitalism taken to the extreme. And you had the introduction of a hive-like civilization called the Borg, who I think are very, very interesting. Not a lot of academic work has been done with them yet that I know of, but the Borg are sort of the ultimate imperialist. They want to they state resistance is futile, you'll become part of our culture no matter what, that sort of thing. One of the most interesting things to talk about in today's political culture.
You had this course over the winter break. I take it this was the first time you had put this course together?
That's correct.
How did your students react to it?
The students enjoyed it very much. My big shock in offering the class for the first time is that many of these 18 and 19-year-old students did not have a lot of prior knowledge of Star Trek. And so in the first day or so of the course, we had a lot of catching up to do just to initiate them into Star Trek lore. I guess I shouldn't have been shocked, but I was a little disappointed that that was the case.
Is that something that's always been the case, do you think, of young people, that Star Trek was not that widespread a phenomenon? Or is the phenomenon winding down with the current Enterprise series coming to an end, with the last two movies in the Star Trek series not having been very successful?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but indications are that this phenomenon is seeming to die down. It's taken a long time. It's really been a long-lived series through all of its iterations, but it looks like it's not doing as well with the present series of Enterprise. It's only going to make it through these four seasons, as opposed to seven seasons for all the others, save for the very first one that only lasted three seasons.
Hardcore Star Trek fans demonstrated outside Paramount Studios last month after word came that Star Trek Enterprise would end its run on the UPN network in May. Paramount says the franchise could come back with an 11th Star Trek movie, perhaps in a couple of years. But the future for Dr. O'Connor's Star Trek course is more certain. He says response to the course he taught over winter break was so positive that Millikan University will offer it again in the fall, as a full semester honors seminar course. I'm Jim Meadows.
Listening to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Sometimes the smallest words have the most complex meanings. Take, for example, the word no, N-O, no. It's a word that actually appears in some form or another in just about all human languages. Bill Palladino opened up his dictionary and tried to figure out what no really means.
We're talking about the word no.
No, 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 no.
No.
No. No. No.
No! No means no.
Well, actually, it doesn't. All due respect to those who believe the word no means no, and I do respect that. The compact edition of the Oxford English Dictionary takes no less than three of its teeny little pages to describe the meanings and derivations of this simple little word. So, does that in itself have meaning?
No, no, no. No, 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 no. No way.
Well, here's what it has to say. No forms. Na, N-A. Nai, N-A-I. Na, N-A-A. Nay, N-A-E. Nay, N-E-A. Nay, N-E-A-Y. Nay, N-E-A-H. Knee, like Monty Python's, "We are the knights who say knee." Nay, N-A-Y, new, N-O-O, no, N-O-E, and finally, no, N-O.
No.
No.
No, no, no.
I won't bore you with the next three pages of text, but to say that it required the supplied magnifying glass and some acrobatic calisthenics of the muscles in and around my eyes. The OED goes on to say, no occurs in a considerable number of common phrases as no bones, no end, no means, no doubt, and my personal additions, no dogs, no frills, no fault, no count, no go, no good, no hitter, no man's land, no name, Nancy's just say no, no nonsense, no parking, no pets, no place, no show, no shit, Sherlock. Whew. But what does it all really mean? No is a funny word. It's not bad, necessarily. Surprisingly, it's not negative, necessarily. But there are so many uses, so many connotations. Should I make assumptions about what it means?
It means not an option.
Don't mess with that. How's that?
To one person, it means
lost rhythm.
And yet, to another person, the same word means exactly the opposite.
This sounds like a song. No, 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 no. You could keep going with this.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that no is the most oft-repeated word in American popular song. Sorry, all you romantics, it's not love. Freddie Mercury of Queen, in one of the most popular rock songs of all time, Bohemian Rhapsody, threw the little bugger in seven times in a row. Janis Joplin once improvised a version of George Gershwin's Summertime and added the word no for effect 40 times in succession. I guess she really meant it, but what did she mean? I don't know. The Isley Brothers had a hit song in the 60s titled Nobody But Me, later covered famously by a band called The Human Beings, where to make an affirmative statement, the word no is used no less than 100 times in the song. Nobody can do the shake like I do. No, no, no. Look, I'm going to spare you my choral talents, but really, how can such a bitty, tiny little word mean so much to so many people?
would have to say that means stop now.
No, 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 no. That's not what I mean. Like, I try to say, hold on, hold on. That's what it means in this inference. It
means my cat is doing something he shouldn't be.
It's actually almost the same in a dozen different languages. Trust me, say the word no on 7 continents and people will understand that you don't mean yes. Say the word punctuated with an exclamation point and it has 1 meaning.
No! Oh, that just means like Bill Palladino, I don't want your microphone in my face.
Say it plainly, punctuated with just a period, and it can have a completely different meaning.
No. Bill Palladino, I kind of don't want your microphone in my face.
Well, sort of. However, it doesn't lessen the effect of its many convolutions. There's something about saying the word in succession that seems to amplify its meaning more than any other word I know.
No, 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 no.
There have even been entire books written about the power incumbent in this little word. One by Jana Kemp titled, No, How One Simple Word Can Transform Your Life. Well, the jacket of the book says, No turns the word into a tool for personal power and gives you new ways to help discussions and decisions move forward. This enlightening guide reveals how No can help you protect your time, money, family, and more. It demonstrates that No is a legitimate word that doesn't always need to be negotiated to yes. Hoo-hoo! No, indeed. But will I buy the book?
No.
I think she's right. So I hope I've shed some light on the word no for you. No? Have I confused you even more? No. Well, that's all right. All I ask is that you not take no for an answer. At least not the only answer. I'm Bill Palladino.
That feature was produced by Bill Palladino and Radio Anyway.
Nobody can do the
shaking
like I do. Nobody can do the
shake
like I do. Nobody can do
boogaloo
like I do. Nobody can do
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Joy Lansing. You've probably never heard of her. She was a blonde bombshell pinup and actress in the 1950s and 60s. She appeared in the background in such classics as Singing in the Rain and Touch of Evil. She was also on television, a regular on the Beverly Hillbillies and the Bob Cummings Show, and she was also in some horrible B-grade movies like Hillbillies in a Haunted House and Bigfoot. She was never that famous. She was a working actress getting roles where she could, but her life and career has fascinated writer Joseph Daugherty. He recently wrote a book, actually it's more like a memoir, called Comfort and Joy. It's published by iUniverse. In it, the narrator talks about life, nostalgia, the movies, and of course, Joy Lansing. I talked with Daugherty recently and asked him first to tell us who Joy Lansing is.
She is, as the narrator of the book describes, one of the working stiff character actors who just kind of like runs like a thread through American television and movies in the 50s, 40s, 60s, and right up to the 70s. She was born in Salt Lake City in 1928. She came to Hollywood with her Mormon parents in 1940, broke into show business as a model, and started out as an extra at MGM. And from that point in the early 50s, had this solid but not sterling career that lasted right up until her death from cancer in 1972 when she was 44 years old. She seems to be the one who stuck in my mind. And I'm not 100% sure why. I think that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book, was to see if there was an answer to that question. And I haven't found a definitive answer to that question, neither does the narrator of the book. She's gorgeous. She's sweet. She seemed, I guess I was going to differentiate her from a lot of the other pinup girls from the period. She didn't look like she's working too hard at it. She seems fairly confident. She's not afraid to look you and the camera right in the eye. And she seems to be having as much fun looking like that as you have looking at her.
She was one of these big blonde bombshells
She was a big blonde bombshell. Well, yeah. She was a blonde bombshell. She never got as big as either Mansfield or Mimi Van Doren. She was pretty much the third or fourth choice. She lost roles to Marilyn Monroe in the 50s. And she usually was just like a kind of a she was a go-to babe when everybody else said no, you could get joy. She'd come in, do the work, and say thank you, and take the check and leave.
Well, the interesting thing about this book, Comfort and Joy, is that it's not just a biography of this actress who was the third or fourth pig, but it's also a part memoir where it's set in the context of a weekend at a beach house where the narrator, or you, I guess, you know, I don't know if that's the same
thing. Sometimes it's a little bit more, yeah. Sometimes it's a little bit less.
But it's where the narrator has holed up himself for the weekend with Joy's movies, Joy Lansing's movies,
mm-hmm.
watching them in chronological order, thinking about the movies, thinking about her, thinking about his own life and this nostalgia and putting it all down on paper. Now, tell me about this approach and why you felt it necessary to interact this sort of this introspection with this biography.
A couple of reasons. Frankly, there's probably not enough there for just a straight-out biography of the woman, and I was too lazy to do one anyway. I wanted to see what would happen if you try to understand an actor exclusively by their work, and in this case, a very minor person, and what would have you put the stuff in order, and you started to find out. You started to put her in kind of a context. And I realized that talking about Joy, who was, you know, a great-looking babe, kind of became an armature that lets the narrator talk about his personal experiences with the movies, not the movies as just sources of entertainment, but as a cultural thing that we do, as a thing that society has.
You do make these parallels in the yeah. book between the early days of Joy Lansing's career, when she was just a minor bit, unspeaking character in such big films as Singing in the Rain and Touch of Evil, and then, you know, and that parallels to this glorious time of the movie theater, the movie palace, and then it parallels towards the later part of her career when she's doing these horrible, schlocky B-movies like a Bigfoot movie and then the rundown sort of Buck theaters that you see now.
Well, it's kind of like, I think one of the things that the narrator thinks about is basically he starts, in a weird way, seeing his life as paralleling hers. The realization is that we all would like to be the star of a movie. We think we're the stars of our own movie. But that might not be the best possible picture to be in. She's actually, you know, kind of a witness to great film history, but you have to know where to look for her in there. And I think most of us have the funny feeling that we're not in our own best movie.
Well, with that, there's this kinship with Joy Lansing and this idea of, you know, always being on the edge of somebody else's movie.
Yeah.
And then finding a great comfort in that fact that you're not the center of attention. That's a rather odd observation, you know, considering the culture we live in where everybody wants to be the star of their own movie, but in a way you find this comfort by not being the star. Why is that?
I think it has something to do with the fact that well, it's kind of like, which would you rather be? Would you rather be in a classic movie that's going to live forever, or would you rather be in something that's in the theater right now? You know, would you rather be in Son of Mask? Would you rather star in Son of Mask or be an extra in Casablanca? What's more important to you, immortality or a flash? Are you in it for the long run, or are you in it just for yourself right now? You know, if you want to be in a history book, or do you want to be in People magazine? I think those are the questions he's asking himself.
And for Joy Lansing, she was both. You know, actually, she was in the center of some really horrible movies.
Yes.
And off to the side, acting her heart out and looking amazing and just being such a part of the background.
She was always, I mean, the impression I always got in anything you see her in is that she said, you know what, you hired me, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to do the best damn job I possibly can do because that's what I'm responsible for. I can give you my best work, and I'm not going to judge your movie. I'm only responsible for my best work. It's a strange kind of work ethic, which goes way beyond acting. It's a way of getting, you know, it's like, I'm not responsible for how bad this company is. I'm responsible for my work here. In that way, she becomes this kind of strange, well-built blonde role model for, you know, the Zen concept of before enlightenment, carry water, chop wood. After enlightenment, carry water and chop wood. And with joy, I guess it's like, you know, before enlightenment, look slinky and walk sexy. And after enlightenment, look slinky and walk sexy.
Well, do you still think about Joy Lansing and the effect she's had on you and the narrator of the book?
Yeah, I continue to think about it. It's interesting. I ran across a statistic. It was in Va Va Voom. It's a book. Joy ranks way above a lot women who are a lot more famous. She's been dead for 30 years, and she's still like in the top 50 all-time pinups. And I think that part of it is basically is she just kept going. She showed up. She did her job. I think it's a strange message I think she's giving us across the years is that basically, show up and do your work. You really don't have control of what posterity is going to say. You've just got to keep going up, and maybe if you work hard, you'll be at the edge of the frame in Singing in the Rain, or you'll be the girl who blows up at the beginning of Touch of Evil. And unfortunately, you might be the star of Bigfoot and Hillbillies in a Haunted House, but you know you're in some classics, too. You did your work.
That was Joseph Daugherty, author of Comfort and Joy, a book about life, the movies, and blonde bombshell actress Joy Lansing. It's published by iUniverse. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.